Welcome to tonight's ShareShare teleconference entitled, Am I a Survivor? What You Should Know Now About Breast Cancer Survivorship. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. We'll be taking questions later on during tonight's program, and we'll provide instructions for asking a question at that time. Please note today's call is being recorded. It's now my pleasure to introduce Rochelle Shortz. Please begin.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us this evening as we present the teleconference, Am I a Survivor? What You Need to Know Now About Breast Cancer Survivorship. I'm Rochelle Shortz. I'm the founder and executive director of Sharsheret and a two-time breast cancer survivor. Sharsheret is the Hebrew word for chain, and it's a national organization that supports young Jewish women facing breast cancer. I'll soon have the pleasure of introducing our distinguished speakers who will share their insights into what has become a critical subject for those affected by breast cancer, survivorship. I want to take this opportunity to welcome all of you calling from different time zones. We actually have participants from 37 states and 4 countries, and many more are certain to join us as a transcript of the teleconference remains available online after tonight's presentation. I'd like to begin by thanking the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for the grant that enabled Sharsheret to develop Thriving Again, a program to support Jewish breast cancer survivors. In developing this program, we spent a year speaking with more than 1,700 of you in person and through surveys about your needs as breast cancer survivors. And interestingly, the first question most of you asked us was, am I really a survivor? 24% of you felt that you were a survivor when you were first diagnosed, another 28% when you completed treatment, 25% after your first anniversary with no recurrence. 13% of you told us you don't consider yourself a survivor yet and perhaps gave us a life milestone as to when you would feel like one. And 9% of you told us you felt you were a survivor even in the midst of treatment. Wow. That's a wide range of responses to an important question about the timing of the survivorship period and one that raises a host of other questions that are being explored now in research studies and survivorship clinics. With more than 2.9 million breast cancer survivors in the U.S. alone in 2012, survivorship research and programs like ours will play a critical role in cancer care in the years ahead. In developing Sharsheret's new survivorship program, we also learned that you had questions about transitioning from treatment to care after treatment, that you wanted to know more about what you could do to safeguard your health, and that you wanted to connect with others who may be experiencing the same concerns as breast cancer survivors. Tonight, our speakers will address those questions and more, and will introduce you to Thriving Again, Sharsheret's new survivorship program, so that you can continue to connect with us and other survivors throughout your breast cancer journey. I'll lead us off tonight by sharing a bit about my own survivorship journey and some of the unique challenges of addressing survivorship as a young Jewish woman. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer 12 years ago, I became obsessed with the calendar. I counted the weeks between surgery and treatment. I counted each day of radiation. I counted the months until I no longer had to renew my prescription for tamoxifen. And I spent hours wondering when I could actually count myself among the thousands of breast cancer survivors in the world. Looking back, I understand that what I was really trying to do with all that counting was to put cancer behind me. I've learned slowly that it's much more important that I learn to walk comfortably with the cancer experience at my side. Well, that's easier said than done, especially when there has not been a clear roadmap to survivorship. I don't know how many of you had a chance to read today's Wall Street Journal, but there's a piece in there about rehabilitation for cancer survivors with a great quote from Dr. Catherine Weaver. She writes, "When cancer patients are diagnosed, everyone sits down to look at the case, decide what to do, and convey that plan to the patient. But the same sort of process doesn't happen to survivors of the treatment." Well, when do we become cancer survivors? Some will say it's the day we're diagnosed with breast cancer. Others will say it's the last day of active treatment. Still others will say survivorship is a mindset, the time at which you view yourself as a survivor of the disease. For those like me who are living with metastatic breast cancer and still undergoing active treatment, more questions arise. Are we ever considered survivors of a disease for which there is no known cure? What, if anything, do we need to understand about survivorship if we don't consider ourselves a part of this conversation? And how do any of us on the line reconcile the term survivor with that persistent voice in our head that often whispers, it's going to come back, it's just a matter of time? Discussing the definition of the survivorship period with your healthcare team, whether it's your oncologist, your nurse practitioner, or a social worker, is the first critical step in managing that voice and in understanding your needs as a breast cancer survivor. 12 years after my diagnosis, I still discuss concerns and fears with my own medical team. Keeping on top of emerging research through Charcharid and other cancer organizations also helps me mitigate the anxiety of survivorship. And connecting with other long-term survivors through Charcharid helps me understand that I'm not alone, that in fact there are thousands of other young survivors with some of the very same questions and concerns that I have. So there may not be a clear consensus on the answer to the question, when does the survivorship period begin? There is certainly agreement that it is never too early to begin thinking about issues of survivorship. From the moment we're diagnosed, through treatment and beyond, we should be asking questions about fertility, bone health, nutrition, and exercise. Starting that conversation can be as easy as asking your own doctor, when am I considered a survivor, and what do I need to know about survivorship? The Thriving Again program we've developed at Charcharid will help guide you in starting those conversations, no matter where you are in your cancer journey, and we'll talk more about that program later on in the call. For Jewish women, identifying as a breast cancer survivor can take on a host of other unique concerns. Not long after I founded Charcharid, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal called to discuss survivorship and asked me a question that caught me off guard. She wanted to know if the term survivor was more troubling to Jewish women who may associate the descriptive term survivor with someone who has lived through the Holocaust. We've heard that concern from a few of the women who called Charcharid. One in particular described feeling uncomfortable calling herself a survivor because her own mother had survived World War II, and she had heard so much growing up about what it really took to be a survivor. But in truth, concern about the term survivor seems to stem less from a place of Jewish history and more from a sense of Jewish superstition. Whether you call it an evil eye or a tempting fate, some would rather not call themselves survivors, lest some higher power come to deny them that status. Better not to embrace the term and to transition quietly into survivorship. And for other Jewish women in the Orthodox or Hasidic community, breast cancer can often be taboo, something shrouded in secrecy, and the survivorship period, therefore, continues in secrecy. Discomfort with the term or state of survivorship can be difficult today. We live in an age of breast cancer races and walks, pink products everywhere, and celebrations of survivorship by cancer organizations worldwide. And so, as survivors, we need to be mindful that the survivorship period may, at first, bring with it more questions and concerns than pink balloons and celebrations. Of course, women of all religion and culture share common concerns and strategies in life beyond cancer. Prayer and meditation, for example, are two ways in which women across the spectrum draw renewed strength and spirituality. A few of the women of Charcharid, for example, have found comfort in prayers they recited during active treatment, which they have now incorporated more completely into their lives post-treatment. Some have been enriched by Tehillim, Psalms, that they often recite on behalf of those facing illness. Others even create their own prayers as a meaningful rite of passage to life beyond cancer. But beyond prayer, I'd like to touch on some of the unique ways in which breast cancer affects the Jewish woman, particularly in the survivorship period. First, using the mikvah, or ritual bath, can be a time of renewed healing. For some, immersion in the mikvah is a custom associated with marriage that can take on added meaning after surgery and after treatment. Using the mikvah can also be a time to embrace new traditions, as the waters and all they symbolize bring hope for health. For others, immersion in the mikvah can force a confrontation with body image and sexuality. It can be a trying time, a difficult time, particularly if discussions about intimacy and body have been ignored during the hectic pace of active treatment. Wearing a wig or a hat beyond active treatment can raise a second series of concerns for the Jewish cancer survivor. Many assume that wearing a wig or a hat must be easier for those observant Jewish women who cover their hair after marriage. But covering your head because you've embraced a positive religious ritual is very different from covering your head because you've lost your hair to cancer. And for single women who cover their heads during cancer treatment, doing that, which is traditionally associated with marriage, only complicates already complicated emotions. Many young Jewish women living beyond breast cancer struggle with hair covering. For some, wearing a wig post-treatment can be a painful reminder of cancer, a continuation of the struggle to cope with the side effects of a traumatic diagnosis. Others find added meaning in the ritual and choose to cover their hair with a deeper appreciation for its inherent beauty. Perhaps one of the most urgent subjects for the young Jewish survivors that we hear from at Sharsheret is fertility and the related concerns about parenting, both of which have a tremendous emphasis in the Jewish community. For those survivors who remain fertile, the decision whether or not to have children after breast cancer often adds another dimension to the anxiety of survivorship. For those with cancers that were hormone receptor positive, fears of recurrence are triggered at the mere thought of the hormones coursing during pregnancy. These are fears that are played out over and over again for young Jewish survivors, fears that add another dimension to Jewish milestones like weddings and bar mitzvahs, where many cancer survivors are likely to be thinking, I hope I live to see this moment too. These are fears that weigh heavy during Jewish holidays, particularly during the New Year holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which trigger serious introspection about matters of life and death. At the same time, these Jewish milestones and these Jewish holidays can be a time for celebration, for affirming life and embracing the challenges of survivorship. We are fortunate to live at a time when the discourse about survivorship is ripe. Tonight, we are proud to be a part of that growing conversation and grateful that you're here with us to contribute to it. And with that, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Jennifer Klemp. Dr. Klemp is graciously substituting for Dr. Patricia Gans on tonight's call. Dr. Gans had a family emergency and apologizes for not being able to participate. Thank you so much, Dr. Klemp, for being with us on such short notice. Dr. Klemp is the director of the Cancer Survivorship Center at the University of Kansas Campus Center in Kansas City. She was recently invited to serve on the National Cancer Survivorship Resource Center's Quality of Life Survivorship Programs and Navigation Workgroup. She has a clinical research interest in understanding breast cancer risk and cancer genetics, lifestyle modification targeting cancer risk reduction and improving quality of life, and the delivery of cancer survivorship care. Tonight, Dr. Klemp will address your questions about transitioning beyond active treatment, managing the fear of recurrence, and steps we can all take to maintain a healthy lifestyle as survivors. Welcome, Dr. Klemp.
Thank you very much, Rochelle, for that warm welcome, and thank you to all of you who are participating in this conference tonight, and to our host at Sharsheret, as well as my colleague and friend, Lily Shockney. I want to build on Rochelle's wonderful definition and sort of the complicated nature of how do we define survivors. I think that this constantly impacts our patients, but from a provider side, it also causes some issues with transition. And when we talk about cancer survivors, as providers, we do consider survivors from the time of diagnosis. However, I think that often gets complicated with how we deliver what we call survivorship care. And the Institutes of Medicine, which Lily will talk with you about a little bit later, has defined the role of survivorship and also how we kind of compartmentalize survivorship care. I think many of us like to expand that role so that if we do talk about those who are at the time of diagnosis and treatment, survivorship care may look like education or prevention so that we can prevent possible side effects or long-term effects downstream. Some of those examples I'll talk a little bit more about, but they may include things like energy balance, or that's kind of the friendly term we use for diet and exercise. We may want to help educate you on lymphedema prevention, especially if a patient's had a lot of lymph nodes removed. And it's very important to talk about some of the psychosocial and coping strategies that are very important as you go through your cancer journey. When we talk about the patient who's now transitioning from that active or acute treatment into post-treatment care, that's oftentimes where survivorship care is really defined. And I can give you kind of an example from our clinic. I opened our center in 2006, and it is a multidisciplinary clinic. I've spent years sort of building a landscape so that we have collaborators in cardiology, fertility preservation, endocrine. And survivorship really needs to look like that interdisciplinary team, because there are issues that may arise both from the diagnosis or treatment, but also there's often complications that our patients come into that diagnosis with. So if you think about our average breast cancer survivor, at least in Kansas City, I think it's different on some of the coasts, but we have a lot of our patients who are already overweight or may have weight control issues. You think about issues related to diabetes or hypertension or other cardiovascular risks. So our patients are sort of complicated when they come into the diagnosis. Other patients don't have those complications. So that really lends to that personalized approach as to how we deliver survivorship care, and then we need to have that infrastructure in place to help deliver that care. Lily's going to explain more about that more comprehensive and structured delivery of care in a few minutes. The last part of this delivery of survivorship care has to do with our patients, as Rochelle pointed out, who have advanced or metastatic disease. I think we've often compartmentalized our metastatic patients and have not provided them with the same resources that may be available to patients with earlier stage disease. We've recently done some additional focus groups to better understand what types of targeted issues were being unmet by our metastatic patients. And I think some of the key factors that have really impacted how we deliver care had to do with things like sexual health and wanting to have intimacy and how do we redefine intimacy. It also had to do with how do I function in my day-to-day role. And also, how do we keep active and try to stay as healthy as possible? So I think it's very important to think about survivorship care at all points of the continuum, from that time of diagnosis and treatment to when we transition from active treatment into post-treatment care, and then also for patients who are dealing with a more chronic stage of disease. The other important issue where I think survivorship plays such an important role is that, as many of you know, because we keep reading in the newspaper every time we have a large national conference, we extend the amount of time that our patients are exposed to anti-hormonal therapy. And so this is a very important issue with adherence, or helping our patients stay on their drug as directed so it can help not only improve their outcomes, but it's our job to help our patients manage some of the side effects that may arise from these drugs. So as you can see, survivorship isn't, once again, sort of a defined time point. I think it really needs to be considered across the continuum of care, taking a personalized approach to your needs and trying to meet those needs with a multidisciplinary approach. So talking just a little bit more about some of those side effects, I want to give you sort of two different terms. There's the term you'll read called long-term side effects, and then there's the term called late side effects. And I do want to give you a little bit of differential between those two, because it doesn't mean we necessarily treat things any differently, but it does make a difference in how you're part of your healthcare, so you can look for some of these side effects, and then what should you expect downstream as a result not only of our natural aging process, but because of some of the treatments that you may have been exposed to. So long-term side effects are things that may happen during the diagnosis and treatment. So if we think about the fact of surgery, maybe that can cause some scar tissue and some pain. We may have risks of swelling or lymphedema. We also can have fatigue, loss of fertility, changes in our cognition. And those effects may persist even once the treatment is done. Late effects are things that may happen to you downstream. So I'm sure many of you have heard of some of the effects that some of the treatments that we give can increase risk for things like cardiovascular disease, maybe a little bit of weight gain. And so if we can better prepare and educate our patients up front for some of those late effects that they may be at increased risk for, then not only are you empowered to be part of the process, but we've better prepared you for managing or preventing some of those late effects, and so that you're looking out for those early symptoms so we can intervene as early as possible. And as you can hear from some of my messaging, I am a very altruistic person, but I do believe that you, the patient, are the center and the only locus of control. So you have to be part of the process from the time of diagnosis all the way through your journey. And that means asking questions, and that means making sure that you're using your voice. And then the last part that I've been asked to talk about has to do with sort of healthy living. And I used the term energy balance earlier. It's one of the terms that is used in the literature, but our patients also appreciate that term because I think it has a little more hopeful feel than weight management or diet and exercise. So energy balance really has to deal with getting you back in balance, and obviously that has to do with keeping you moving. It has to do with what we eat and how our body's able to process that. And there's some basic guidelines that we talk with our patients about. And the American Cancer Society, as well as other organizations, summarize these very nicely. The first is they want us to achieve and maintain a healthy weight. Well, we know that's important for all of us. But in particular, weight and what's called BMI, or it's sort of a calculation of our height and our weight, that is a risk factor that's associated not only with things like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other chronic illnesses, but there's also an association for developing an initial breast cancer as well as for recurrence. So an important factor to mention is that this is an association. So there's lots of things that go into a diagnosis. But what we do, when we talk about energy balance, that's one thing where we can be in charge, where we can move a little bit more on days we feel well, or we can then start to engage in a slow and progressive exercise program. And that's a very important target for us. And I encourage our patients, even when they're going through treatment, if you feel good on a given day, go ahead and take a walk or make sure you're staying active. And if you don't feel very well that day, then just take it easy. As you continue to gain energy and as you continue to persist into out of your acute treatment, it's very important to continue exercising on a regular basis. We also know that resistance training can be helpful, and that's using some light weights, but it's also very important to have instruction because there can obviously be some risk depending on some of the other issues that we talked about today, like having lymph nodes removed. So this is once again a very important discussion to have with your provider. It's also important to maintain a healthy diet, and that includes eating, obviously, as many fruits and vegetables and whole grains as we can, also looking at some of the other dietary requirements for maintaining a healthy weight, which may include calorie restriction to help us lose weight. So achieving a healthy weight may include our active role of losing weight. And one of the things that Jen Thompson will talk with you about in a few minutes are some of the resources that you'll have available, which include some exercise DVDs as well as either a Kosher or the Back in the Swing cookbook. And these are great resources to help you understand how to achieve that healthy weight and how to keep active and eat things that not only taste good but also have some healthful benefits as well. And then the last part of that healthy living has to do with supplementation, and we do need to be careful with supplementation. These are medicines just like some of the other pills that we take, so make sure that you're fully disclosing what medicines and supplements you do take with your provider to make sure there's no contraindications or interference between the supplement and some of the other medications that have been prescribed. So with that, I am going to transition back to Rochelle, who will introduce Lily. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Klemp. We'll all have an opportunity to ask Dr. Klemp questions during the question and answer period at the end of the teleconference, but first allow me to introduce our next speaker, Lily Shockney. Ms. Shockney is a University Distinguished Service Associate Professor of Breast Cancer and the Administrative Director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Center since 1997. A two-time breast cancer survivor, she's a published author of more than 13 books, a nationally recognized public speaker on the subject of breast cancer, and the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Oncology Navigation and Survivorship. Tonight, Ms. Shockney will provide an overview of what survivorship care plans are, the different types of care plans available to you, how you can complete them with your medical team, and how they can help ease anxiety as you navigate your breast cancer journey. Welcome, Ms. Shockney, and thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me, and I'm thrilled to know that there's so many people that are listening in this evening. So I want to start off by saying that I know that many of you who are tuned in with us this evening are perhaps just winding down your acute treatment, being surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, Others of you may have completed these phases of acute treatment some time ago and are in short-term or perhaps even long-term survivorship care. And there's individuals who are going to always be receiving some degree of treatment and are living with their cancer, being stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. So I want to talk a little bit first about treatment summaries and survivorship care plans. One of the catalysts, interestingly enough, for the development of and need for these actually came from two different avenues. One was the recognition that there is a growing shortage of oncology specialists in the United States, while there's a dramatically increasing incidence of individuals diagnosed with cancer and subsequently surviving their cancer, with 24% of individuals diagnosed today who are survivors, like myself and all of you, are in fact breast cancer survivors. As a result of this, is projected by the year 2020 that we will have a 41 to 48% deficit of oncologists in the United States. That's a very big number to be having to deal with. And as a result of that, oncologists, whether they be surgical oncologists, medical oncologists, or radiation oncologists, will not be able to follow cancer patients, and specifically breast cancer patients and survivors long term. So the necessity for us to engage very much in understanding what our treatment is, participate in the decision-making about the treatments that we are receiving, and have a really nicely laid out treatment summary as well as a survivorship care plan that really does serve as a guide as to what needs to happen going forward, what type of surveillance will we need to have done, who will be responsible for doing that. And I really emphasize today to survivors, we as survivors have to step up to the plate and make sure that we are engaging in self-management on behalf of ourselves. Primary care physicians have been experiencing a shortage of them for longer than what I can even count. I recently read a research article that made me feel very sad. tens of thousands of physicians participated in it. It was a time motion study performed on primary care physicians demonstrating that every 16 minutes is the length of time that we have with a primary care physician, and that during that time, the amount of time that is being spent on the reason why we went to that doctor is 14 minutes for a cold, flu, backache, whatever it is that we may have. They reserve then 1 minute to talk about other comorbid conditions we may have of asthma or high blood pressure, et cetera. And that leaves 1 minute, and I mean that literally 1 minute left for cancer survivorship. So you can imagine that if we don't take the bull by the horns and make sure that we are having our needs addressed and assuming some responsibility and also addressing those needs, then something's going to fall through the cracks. At the same time all of this was happening, Hurricane Katrina hit, and the tens of thousands of individuals that lived in New Orleans and were cancer survivors or currently cancer patients undergoing active treatment, there were no medical records that, in essence, survived. Patients didn't know what treatments they were receiving. For breast cancer patients I spoke to on the phone, they said, I'm getting a red medicine in my vein. I think I get it every 2 weeks, but I can't remember. I think I've had 2 cycles, but maybe it's been 3. So a natural disaster can also force us to take a look at how are we record keeping and how are we engaging patients and making sure that they do understand what their treatment has been and what is needed as we go forward for survivorship. So from a treatment summary perspective, first, it's important that we know who your treatment team has been to date and how do you go about reaching them. Oftentimes, physicians will hand out their business cards, but if you call the number on there, you may find out that they don't take patient calls and that there's someone else, perhaps a nurse practitioner, who's the one that handles that on their behalf, and you weren't informed about that. a summary of your genetics evaluation, including testing results, and your family's history of breast and ovarian cancer, as well as other types of cancers, whether that be melanoma or colorectal, pancreatic, etc. And keep in mind that as family members are newly diagnosed in the future, and there will be some that this will happen to, that portion of the summary needs to be updated. It's something that I've been talking to PCPs about over the last 2 years as a gentle reminder to always, whenever they're seeing a cancer survivor, to ask that question, have any of your family members been diagnosed with cancer since I last saw you? Because though we may not have thought about a genetic link initially, over time, as more individuals potentially get diagnosed within a family, we then may want to steer people to genetics counseling and potentially subsequent testing. So who will want to have recorded the details of your treatment, what surgeries have been performed, if lymph nodes were removed, and how many were taken out, and the details of your pathology results, including the type of breast cancer that you had, the prognostic factors of that pathology report, and specifically about those tumor cells, the pre-chemotherapy test results that were done, like an echocardiogram, for example, details about chemotherapy, if it was part of your treatment, and if you participated in a clinical trial, and if so, which one was it? What side effects did you experience during your treatment, and what ones are continuing to linger now if you've perhaps completed your chemotherapy, radiation, and other treatments? Also, what possible side effects in the form of long-term side effects should you know about that may crop up in the future and could not appear perhaps for a decade from now? The same applies to radiation therapy and hormonal therapy. At any point for treatment, when treatment stops or is put on hold due to severity of side effects or perhaps low blood counts, all of that should be noted. List all of the medications that you take, including over-the-counter meds and any herbs or vitamins or other substances that you're taking, and that includes anything topically. All of the above information that I've just referenced is important so that you and others are not relying on a memory 10 to 20 years from now regarding what your treatment entailed. We all think that because we've been through it and remember it oh so well, that we will always remember it. And it's sort of like giving birth to a baby. You remember the really hard labor in retrospect and just have a vague image of it. And it's important to also provide clues to certain symptoms that you develop later, which may be related to your treatment. And it is also very important if you were, heaven forbid, to develop recurrence as the same treatments you have had in the form of medicines and radiation may not be able to be given to you again. Follow-up recommendations need to be customized to you. Though there are some guiding principles, that doesn't mean that all breast cancer survivors have the same follow-up instructions by any means. And the only two cancer diagnoses at the current time that do have definitive surveillance follow-up guidelines are breast and colorectal cancer. The NCCN is busy working on the developments of others for other types of cancers, but currently it is only breast and colorectal that's in print. So in looking at how things might vary from one survivor to another, if you had had bilateral mastectomies, you would no longer need to have, for example, mammograms performed. Whereas if you had a lumpectomy, you would likely be getting a mammogram on the affected breast twice a year for 1 to 2 years, then resuming annually thereafter. Your specific situation may warrant an MRI at specific intervals. For those on certain hormonal therapy drugs, a bone density test would need to be performed and documented and specified at what intervals. Pelvic exams and their frequency also needs to be clearly stated and followed. One of the nice tools contained in the treatment summary and survivorship care plan that this organization providing you this online conference this evening is the ability to check in with yourself, and I thought that was a very clever way to document this, and to perform a self-assessment. So having information regarding how you can help to manage long-term side effects, deal with fear of recurrence, and I'm 20 and a half years out, and it still has totally not left my brain. When I get an ache or pain or a cold that won't go away, it certainly is what's on my mind. Also, decision-making in the future about genetics counseling and testing, understanding your patient's rights, too, are all important to know about. We all know that though breast cancer happens to you, it really has affected everyone who lives with you and certainly everyone who loves you. Receiving guidance regarding how to communicate to your children, if appropriate, about their genetic risk, and even deciding how much information you want to share with others needs to be discussed. You may have some specific concerns regarding your children, too, such as your comfort level on your daughter going on the birth control pill in the future. There is also a section that focuses on health and well-being concerns. Some are associated with lifestyle behaviors that you may want to consider improving, such as weight management, smoking cessation, exercise, understanding and managing fatigue. Coping with anxiety issues are all important to address. There may be also some treatments that have resulted in your inability to fulfill some of your life goals, becoming infertile, for example, as a side effect of chemotherapy and/or hormonal therapy. And for those who are still in treatment, knowing what questions to ask related to the opportunity for fertility preservation. Are you eligible to adopt a child in the future? What is the risk of passing a breast cancer gene on to your children? For those who are single, deciphering when is the right time to bring up your medical history with someone that you're newly dating or forming a relationship with. For those in a relationship, when and how to feel comfortable resuming sexual activity. How can you manage menopausal symptoms and their impact on intimacy? And last but not least is a session on psychosocial and spiritual concerns. There can be a tendency among those you love as well as those you work with to not thinking and feeling the same way that you that your treatment is considered when you hear the word that your treatment is done. That word done, as we know, is a very relative word in this equation. Others may expect you to go back to your old self, whatever that was. You have been through a life-altering experience, however, and you need to work within yourself to determine and understand what does surviving all of this mean to you, how to acclimate yourself to your new body image. You may be mourning the loss of your breasts, or you may have taken this experience and decided to find all of the pearls that come from it. Whatever your experience and decision, it is very personal, and you may want to speak with your rabbi or your spouse or other person that you feel close to. I've heard people say that the patient has to, quote, adjust to her new normal or perhaps find her new normal as if it is missing. I prefer to recommend to patients, and I say this at the time that I first meet them, which is usually within 48 hours of them having heard those words, you have breast cancer, I tell them I want to work with you to help you design your new normal. We're going to create your new normal. You don't have to settle for something, and you don't have to accept something, and you certainly don't have to go and hunt for your new normal. So let's see what we can do to prevent side effects or diminish them. Let's keep you on track for your life goals whenever possible, including that fertility preservation by being proactive prior to us even beginning any treatments. But it's not too late in many cases to still implement those life goals at the finale of treatment, but you need to bring them up and make your oncology team aware of them. So who should have copies of these documents? Well, your oncology team members, certainly, your gynecologist, your PCP, and of course, you. But I've also wondered about whether or not will the time come that we should be providing a copy of these also to our health insurance carriers. These are the people and the companies that we expect to be paying for the surveillance tests that are going to be done, the frequency with which we're going to be examined and by whom, et cetera. And I think that at some point in time we need to bring them into the fold rather than just assuming that they are going to automatically provide pre-authorization for the things that your oncology team has deemed are important to be happening. There's also a need to be clear about the delineation of responsibilities as to who is to do what. so that we don't duplicate a test or we don't omit a test. So, for example, your gynecologist may be assuming that your PCP is ordering your mammogram or your bone density when the PCP is assuming the opposite. So you could result in having two of these tests done or none of these tests done, or a mammogram done and 3 months later another mammogram done. Additional information that is not part of the survivorship care plan but should be considered for inclusion are wellness and other cancer screenings, such as colonoscopy, when to get your flu shot, how about a shingles vaccine, your dental visits, as well as what your results were from your scans that may have been done in the past if a staging workup was for some reason needed to be performed. This type of summary enables you to move forward with short and long-term follow-up care. And for those of you who do not have such a document, it is never too late to create your own. You can request copies of your medical records from the various oncology providers who took care of you. And if you have trouble translating the information contained within it, then you can call the hotline 866-474-2774 and get assistance. You might also want to talk with the nurse practitioner who has been involved with your care or the nurse navigator who has been involved with coordination of your care. It is of particular importance for me to mention that cancer centers that are accredited as NCI-designated community cancer centers, teaching cancer centers, or comprehensive cancer centers are required to be providing these types of documents as part of survivorship care. These standards were developed and implemented beginning in 2012, which now has gone by, and by the year 2015, there is an expectation that all cancer survivors, no matter what type of cancer that they have, will be having in their hand these types of documents. And ideally, a treatment summary would grow concurrently as the treatment is taking place. This is of particular need for this, as I mentioned, because of the shortage that we are facing of oncologists. And I caution you in saying that you may have an oncologist that reassures you and says, oh, my dear, I will be seeing you forever. Don't worry about any of this. As his conveyor belt gets speeded up and we try to put 10 pounds of salt in his 5-pound bag, what will happen is that he will today perhaps be seeing 5 newly diagnosed and following 20 follow-up patients. A year from now, he may, though, be seeing 8 newly diagnosed patients, and he does not have time to still see those 20 follow-ups. And those follow-ups is where you are. There are currently 14 million cancer survivors, of which 24% are us, breast cancer survivors. That number is going to grow to 22 million by the year 2020. And we are a large, large, large group of those individuals. So take pride in being a survivor. For those that are dealing with metastatic disease, I want to tell you a mantra I promised Rosemary, one of our survivor volunteers who passed away a year and a half ago, has always asked me to mention, which is women who are surviving with their disease and living with stage 4 breast cancer have a choice. They can be dying each day, or they can be living each day with their disease. And I feel confident that all of you out there are making strides in living with your breast cancer. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Shockney. It's chock full of information, and I know plenty of us will have questions for you during the question and answer period. But first, I wanted to introduce Jennifer Thompson, who is the Survivorship Program Supervisor at Sharsheret, who will tell us more about Sharsheret's new Thriving Again program and the ways in which we can all participate. She's also responsible, along with Donna Averbrook of our staff, for putting together tonight's teleconference, so I want to thank them both while I have them on the line. Jennifer?
Thank you, Rochelle. Tonight we have heard a lot about what it means to be a breast cancer survivor. We have explored some of the issues that breast cancer survivors face, such as diet and exercise, and we have learned a lot about the survivorship, what survivorship care plans are and how they can help be helpful to you as you navigate your breast cancer journey. Before we start taking questions, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the exciting new program that Sharsheret has to offer that addresses these and many more of the concerns that you have. Sharsheret's survivorship program, Thriving Again, offers breast cancer survivors support navigating your entire breast cancer journey. Whether you are newly diagnosed, years beyond treatment, or living with metastatic disease, there is something for you. When you connect with Char Sherritt, a member of our clinical team will speak with you about where you are in your breast cancer journey and what your unique needs are. Our team can connect you with a certified genetic counselor that offers both individual and family counseling sessions, a peer supporter who can speak with you about many of your survivorship needs. Once you have completed treatment, you will also receive your tailored survivorship kit that we've spoken about briefly this evening. The kit includes information on many of the topics that we've heard about tonight, and you'll also be able to choose from a number of other resources that might be important to you, such as family planning, parenting, using the mikvah, and preparing for Jewish holidays as a survivor. Your kit also includes a customized care plan and guidance from our clinical staff on how you can complete it with your healthcare team. Finally, you'll choose a healthy living cookbook for us to include and select one of our 5 fitness DVDs, all which can help you live the healthiest lifestyle possible. Sometimes it's helpful to know that there is someone you can call with your questions whenever you have them, and that's what Thriving Again offers. It offers the tailored support and help navigating your unique journey through breast cancer. It's pretty easy to order a kit. If you haven't ordered one already, the link will be provided to you in the email that you receive tomorrow from Char Sherritt. If you have any questions about the kit or trouble ordering, you can always give our office a call at 866-474-2774. And with that, I'm going to open the floor for questions and answers this evening. You can ask questions of all of our speakers, and we will try to get to as many of the questions as possible. We have over 80 participants on the call this evening, though, so it might be a little challenging. The only thing that I ask is if you could please keep your questions general and broad so that all of our participants can benefit from the discussion. And Kevin will tell you how you can dial in to ask your questions.
To ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, to ask a question, please simply press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone at this time.
All right. Well, we're going to jump right into the questions. The first one is for Rochelle. As a seasoned cancer survivor of 12 years, do you have any tips for new survivors?
Well, now that Lily Shockney has spoken, I don't feel so seasoned anymore. She's the real survivorship expert. But if I could share, I guess, one of the nuggets that I've taken away from my cancer journey, I would say it would be this. I think as a survivor, one of the most important things for me has been learning to keep my mind as healthy as my body often feels. Right, I feel okay so many of the days. And, you know, I think it's important for me to keep my head in the game and recognize that although there might be times that I feel fearful and anxious, I'm okay and learning to live comfortably beside cancer. I think the challenge that many of us face is when we let our heads get ahead of our bodies and take us to that bad place. I think because survivorship is such an important topic now, there are so many groups and organizations like Char Sherritt that are offering continued support for survivors. There's a community for us. There's a place to reach out when we go to that bad place. And making sure that we keep our heads as healthy as our body feels has been a really important factor in my own survivorship journey. I'd be curious to hear what Lily has to say about that.
So that very, very good point. I think those are incredibly wise words. I have a phrase that I keep on my bulletin board at home as well as at work. And it says, worrying does not empty tomorrow of its troubles. It empties today of its strengths. So I always have to do a, okay, how worried should I be about this symptom or this whatever that it is that's toying with my brain. And I've come to learn that if we allow cancer to keep creeping back into our head too often, then what we've actually done is given cancer more time than it deserved. I only want cancer to be given the time that we need to give it to get rid of it or keep it in control. I don't want it to have any more of my time or your time. Not our family time, our social time, our personal time, our work time, none of it. So I always want to remind myself, and I do, I'm in charge. The cancer is not. Am I doing the right things in order to stay healthy? Yeah, I think I am. If I slip, then I remind myself and say, okay, that cheesecake maybe wasn't a good idea, or the second piece wasn't a good idea. Remaining informed, you know, we really do empower ourselves by having information. That's something that you're all doing this evening. So staying abreast, pun intended, of what's the latest research that's being released that furthered the agenda of understanding better treatments, understanding a clear way of diagnosing, as well as what to expect going forward. As more research studies are completed, I always like to follow up and see, now that we've got 10 years of data, what are the side effects that we didn't know 5 years ago but that we do know now, and how can we make sure that the right people are being alerted about that if they were on that particular drug or received that particular treatment. But hold on to your power, women. We are in charge.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. This question is for Dr. Klemp. And the question is about Herceptin. How long is it recommended that individuals be on it? Or could you offer a little insight into that?
Yes. So Herceptin is a targeted therapy that patients who have a certain type of gene are given, and it's a gene that we all have, but it's whether or not it's turned on. And one thing that I like to do is I compare kind of how cancer works to sort of a car. So if you think about breast cancer, we have sort of the gas tank, and that could be estrogen, and that can fuel how our cancer grows. But the HER2 gene is kind of what turns it on, so it's your ignition. So the drug Herceptin affects that and turns that back up or quiets that gene. So Herceptin is given to patients who are, quote, HER2 positive, where that gene is turned on, and it has improved survival in patients by as much as 50%. So it's truly a targeted therapy that has made a huge difference in the patients of breast cancer survivors. It's generally given for up to a year, and then for women with a more chronic or advanced disease, it can be given long-term. The challenge with Herceptin is it has some side effects to the heart. So if you're receiving that type of treatment, Lily mentioned something called an ejection fraction, and that's a test that's done to look at how efficient that muscle of the heart is that pumps, because Herceptin, just like other drugs like anthracyclines and some of our other types of therapies, can be a little bit harsh on the heart. So it's important to make sure that you have echocardiograms or MUGA scans before you start treatment, and that's what looks at what's called that ejection fraction. And then they're going to put you on a regimen going forward to continue to monitor that. A lot of my research is in cardiac risk and cancer, and one thing I'll say, which I think is truly amazing, not about Herceptin, but which is also amazing, but there was an article out last summer which talked about the fact that long-term breast cancer survivors are more likely to die of cardiovascular disease now than their breast cancer. So this is one reason why we have to look at that bigger picture of our patients as we provide those personalized recommendations going forward. So I hope that answers your question about Herceptin, and it is definitely something you want to talk with your provider about to make sure you understand what type of regimen you're on, how long you'll be on that, and then to talk with them about those side effects.
Thank you so much. I think a follow-up question that some of the women are having is about the best way to stay informed about on current research and studies on specific medications or treatments that they might be on. Where should they be going to find that information?
I can take a stab at it. This is Rochelle. You know, one way to stay on top of emerging research is to stay connected to organizations that offer teleconferences like this one, and there are a host of breast cancer organizations that can keep you apprised of emerging research. So I think staying connected to the breast cancer community, even though our inclination might be to sort of get away from cancer, it's important to keep at least a toe in the door, if not the entire foot. We have second way to keep apprised is we all have follow-up appointments and follow-up scans And so asking your doctor or the nurse practitioner at every appointment, is there anything new that I need to know, is another great way to stay on top of things. And third, for those of you who don't know, there's a big breast cancer symposium called the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium that takes place every December in San Antonio, Texas. The news, local media, and national media always covers research that emerges from San Antonio. So if you do nothing more than sort of turn your antenna on to the news during the week in December that the Breast Cancer Symposium is happening, you'll get a really good synopsis of some of the key studies that are emerging. So those are three quick ways to stay on top of things.
This is Lily Shakti. Let me mention one other, which is if you go to the Johns Hopkins Breast Center website, which is hopkinsbreastcenter.org, on the homepage down the right-hand side, you'll see a little statue of Artemis, the Greek goddess, supposed to be the protector of all women who had 100 breasts. And if you click on her, Artemis is the name of our electronic medical journal. I publish on there the first of every month 25 to 30 abstracts translated into layman's terms that are the result of combing through all of the medical peer review journals that have published evidence-based research associated with breast cancer and breast health. So that gives you a snapshot every month if you want to take a look there. I think one of the things that we can torment ourselves with is a new drug may come out and you'll say, oh, I want to get that drug now. And the drug is appropriate to give during acute treatment, and let's say you're 2 years out and you're doing fine. But you say, well, that drug showed a higher survival rate than the drug that I got, so I want that drug now. You could do this forever. Hopefully we will always have new treatments coming out, and we have to realize that we made decisions at the time of our diagnosis and treatment based on the information available at that moment. I'd also like to mention that there can be a tendency, particularly those as they transition from their oncology specialist team back to their PCP and GYN, to want to ask for a full staging workup. You know, to say, well, I don't think I trust this doctor to be able to take care of me as well as my oncologist was, so I want a PET CT and a bone scan and a chest X-ray and a CAT scan and everything. It really isn't appropriate to do that. There is very specific criteria as to when a staging workup of that nature should be done. If you were to look at my scans that I had done now long ago, and 20 years ago, staging workups were commonplace at the time of diagnosis and for some time after that, you would say, when did she die? Because I've had 19 bone fractures in my lifetime, and they all leave a little distal, a little hot spot on my bone scan. I have various things in my lungs from growing up on a farm, and all of them at one point in time had to be chased down in the form of biopsies, which was very unpleasant. Bone biopsies are no fun. Lung biopsies aren't much fun either. So relying on symptoms instead is what we are to be doing for ourselves, and that the doctors taking care of us should be doing. So if you have a new abnormal symptom of, let's say, right hip pain that is new, it's lingering now and it's consistent for 3 weeks, it's not related to you picking up furniture to lay new carpet or something else that you can account for it, that is appropriate to bring to the attention of the individual, of that provider who's going to be managing you from a survivorship care perspective. That individual should be talking with your oncologist to determine, is this the right time to do a scan, or do we already know the cause of this, and how do we remedy it? Thank you.
And if I could just chime in, this is Jennifer Clamp real quick. I'm a very evidence-based person, as we've just talked about the importance of having information and education.
And there is a very well-respected resource for you if you've never gone there. And it's called, it's through the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN. So if you go to nccn.org, they actually have a patient guideline for breast cancer. And so just like Lily was talking about how it's important to know that things change over time and we have these standard guidelines, this is expert and evidence-based recommendations that are put together that many clinicians across the country follow, as well as this is how insurance companies also will reimburse care. So that's a really nice resource for you guys to take a look at, too. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for that input. And if anyone on the call this evening has questions about those resources or any of the other websites, you can always contact Char Sherritt, and we'll be happy to give you those websites again and share them with you. The next question is for Lily. You talked about it briefly, but could you expand more on what is normal follow-up screening, especially if your medical team isn't proactive and speaking about it with you? What can you expect, or what questions should you be asking?
So I'm a believer in looking at things by stage and prognostic factors. I don't think that one size fits all. So from the perspective of if an individual has had, for example, a lumpectomy, then we would anticipate that she would have a follow-up mammogram on the lumpectomy side twice a year, so every 6 months times 2 years, so that's four in a row of those, while still maintaining an annual mammogram on the contralateral side, on the opposite breast. Once you've hit 2 years of having, quote, normal, unquote, mammograms, so that they weren't seeing something that then subsequently resulted in a biopsy, then women can go on to have annual mammograms again. If the breast imaging radiologist, and please note I did say breast imaging radiologist, I just didn't say radiologist, has determined based on the density of the breast tissue that it is difficult to find the polar bear in that snowstorm of that breast tissue, then it is his or her call as to whether or not a breast MRI should be also part of surveillance and with what frequency that should occur. Some will recommend doing an MR and alternating that 6 months later with the traditional digital mammography. Also, for those who have had mastectomy, whether that be with or without reconstruction, there is no standard that says to get a mammogram of the reconstructed side. We don't take mammograms of an implant laying on the table. We also don't take a mammogram of women's abdominal fat before we move it up, or their hiney fat before we bring it around. So what is more accurate in identifying local recurrence is actually a clinical breast exam. That is the best way to see if there is local recurrence or not. I recommend asking your breast surgeon how much tissue did you or did you not leave behind if you've had skin sparing mastectomy. Some surgeons are a little more, they leave quite a bit of tissue behind. So it's actually like having a giant lumpectomy instead of a true skin-sparing mastectomy. If that surgeon is the type that leaves, let's say, 1 to 2 centimeters of breast tissue behind, you're going to be at higher risk for a local recurrence than someone who does create a relatively thin flap, still maintaining good blood circulation. So you want to know, you know, how talented is that breast surgeon in preventing local recurrence while at the same time maintaining a good cosmetic result. For those who are on hormone therapy, they should expect to be seen every 6 months by an oncology provider. That does not necessarily mean the medical oncologist. It could mean medical oncologist this time, 6 months later, the medical oncology nurse practitioner who's also been involved in your acute treatment and ongoing treatment, and then back to the medical oncologist again. For radiation therapy, usually radiation oncologists will cut the patient loose at the two-year mark, in some cases even sooner than that. It's unusual to see a radiation oncologist follow a patient much beyond the two-year mark today. Where the challenges come in to be are those individuals who are at higher risk, and how closely do they need to be followed, and who should be following them. So for those individuals, for example, who do carry a breast cancer gene and have not done aggressive, proactive surgical intervention of bilateral mastectomies, bilateral salpingo-uvulectomies, then those individuals should be followed in a high-risk clinic because they are high risk for cancer, breast, or ovarian returning, far more so than someone who does not have a breast cancer gene. Where I think the patients and where we need to do a better job is in looking at measuring the risk of local recurrence and risk of distant recurrence and stratifying our long-term follow-up based on that. So someone with stage 3C breast cancer has sadly a very high risk of local recurrence and distant recurrence in the form of metastatic disease. We hold on to those patients for 7 to 8 years because of so many of them are going to have one or the other from a recurrence perspective. If someone is a stage 2 breast cancer survivor, has very favorable prognostic factors of hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, then we're usually comfortable in transitioning that patient usually between the 2 and 3 year mark. So as you see, stratifying based on risk of that recurrence. We as oncology providers, I believe, are responsible to inform the patient the first time we meet her, this is what to expect across the trajectory of your care, that we're forming a relationship here today. Here's the members of the team that are going to be involved in taking care of you. You're going to meet some additional team members once we know a little bit more about the pathology of your tumor, and it will more than likely be at this transition point or this transition point when we will re-engage your PCP and GYM. I'm trying to get a drum up enthusiasm among GYNs and PCPs to never disconnect from the patient.
I think that's a really, really great point. There's so much information here about the transition period and follow-up care. You've provided a lot of that to us. I think one of the great things about the teleconference and some of the takeaways, I hated to interrupt you, but is I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that if they had questions about the follow-up care, that they could also reach out to Shar Sharrett, and we'll certainly be able to provide some of those follow-up questions and help them with a dialogue that they can have with their professionals or their medical team about some of those normal follow-up screenings that they should be doing. For the sake of moving us along, we have quite a queue of questions coming in, and I wanted to get to a couple more because we have a huge one. Several callers have called in, actually, about tamoxifen, and I was wondering if Dr. Klimt could actually address that as well, some of the newest tamoxifen studies that have come out.
Sure. So Rochelle mentioned the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and I was down there in December 2012. And the highlight in regards to tamoxifen, which is generally given to endocrine positive, so that estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, and especially if the woman is premenopausal at the time of diagnosis, they found that giving the tamoxifen therapy for 10 years was superior than our traditional 5 years. And it was once again all over the news and really does make an impact because prior to, we discontinued at about the 5-year mark.
Now, having said that, if you look across the country, you know, providers keep patients on anti-hormonal therapy for all different reasons. And I think the term that is so important to think about, and it's a term that Lily just brought up, is the word risk stratification. And so providers may choose, you know, not to leave patients on longer because maybe the risk is lower or maybe the patient's not tolerating the therapy as well. So it's important to know that data tells us how to achieve ultimate outcomes in a certain population. And usually that population is a very pure, if you will, population of patients who don't necessarily have some of the comorbidities or other health issues that some of our patients have. So it's not always apples to apples. It's often, you know, apples to pears or apples to oranges. So it's very important not to take data and always interpret it to ourselves until we can discuss that with our provider and make sure that we're a best fit for that. And then for many of you, as women transition through the menopause, another transition point, or if they were diagnosed as a postmenopausal woman, we use therapies called aromatase inhibitors, and there's several different types of those. Those are very important drugs, also have very good rates of managing disease and have good outcomes. They do have their own series of side effects, including some bone health issues. So once again, it's important to understand, why do we give these therapies potentially for 5 years or longer? What does the data tell us? And do we fit into that data? So what should our plan or our personal plan be? So I'll stop there and see if I answered that question appropriately.
No, I think that that's great information, and asking our providers is always a great starting point. Thank you so much.
Sure.
The next question is actually for you as well, and piggybacking on the lifestyle changes that you had discussed earlier this evening.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of questions about other things that they could do in lifestyle changes, like smoking and alcohol consumption, et cetera. If you could speak a little bit about, you know, what impact they have on recurrence and, you know, if there are any recommendations for limiting smoking and alcohol drinking, that would be great.
Right. Well, smoking is a carcinogen, or it is a known cancer-related agent. And so smoking cessation is something that, if it hasn't been discussed with you and you are an active smoker or even a light smoker, it's very important to engage in an active smoking cessation program. There are some associations with breast cancer as well, and a lot of studies out there, once again, depending on kind of what you look at and how you slice it, you know, you may find your answer that there's not an association, but the reality is it's very important to target a discontinuation of smoking. It is a very hard task, and so it's one of those things sort of like dieting. It's sort of you try again, and you keep at it, because eventually it does have a lot more payoff by committing to that, but very hard to do. Alcohol has some interesting data, and a lot of it has to do with following populations for long periods of time, and especially in nurses out in the state of California. And so at San Antonio, actually 2 years ago, they had a very nice study by Dr. Leslie Bernstein where she highlighted, you know, how much alcohol can we really drink, and should we just eliminate it altogether? So there's, once again, kind of lots of different stories out there, but the reality is that, you know, we try to justify, well, maybe there's some heart health benefits, so should we drink the red wines? And the average consumption per day was about 4 ounces. So if you measure out 4 ounces, it's really small, and I think we have such a kind of warped perception of portion that that's a very tiny amount. So if you looked at amounts over that on a daily basis, that led to an increased risk for breast cancer. And so it's important to sort of think about, well, I don't drink every day, I only have maybe 2 glasses of wine with dinner on a Friday. And there isn't data on 2 glasses of wine on a Friday. So I think the hard part is that we do encourage very limited intake of alcohol and trying to do that in moderation. And I think that the moral of the story is moderation is a huge part of this. It's sort of finding your balance, and that's why I think energy balance is such a nice term, because it helps us find our groove and allows us, you know, to find that balance. But it's also important to understand that there's always a cost benefit to a lot of things. And sometimes we don't have data to support our decisions, but we do need to be moderate with our behaviors.
Great. Thank you so much. I think it's also a great tie-in to the Churchyard's Thriving Again program. And if you're wanting more information on smoking cessation or alcohol, you can request that information in your tailored survivorship kit, and we'll be happy to provide that to the women who are interested in that information. We are nearing the end of our teleconference this evening, and the last question is actually going to go to both you, Dr. Klemp, and Lily, and it's sort of generally, if you could each offer just one thing that you think breast cancer survivors need to know, the one takeaway that you would offer them this evening, that would be fantastic. And we can start with you, Lily, and then we'll go to Dr. Klemp as well.
I'm a believer that no matter how wonderful we thought our life was or wasn't before we were diagnosed, that we should use this experience to the good and create a life for ourselves that truly is a wonderful life. There can be times that you may say, well, I don't think I'm going to do that because I continue to deal with all these side effects. I want you to seek the pearls. Those of you that may know me, I very purposefully set out to do that, feeling that this was perhaps why this happened to me. And I still feel that way 20 years later.
Thank you. And Dr. Klemp?
I think building on what Lily just mentioned, I think that it's our responsibility, regardless of what our situation is, to be empowered. And we do that with education and by asking questions and being part of that process. The other part of that, which I think is very important for us to think about, is that we have to have realistic expectations of what we're doing, what our outcomes will be, and what's realistic in regards to the medical community and the treatments that we have access to. And we talked about some of the great programming that we have in our community. I mean, we have breast cancer survivorship centers and high-risk programs, but not all communities have access to those resources. So I think it's very important to understand what are the ideals and what do we hope for you, but that may not be possible. So sometimes you may know more or ask questions of your providers that they may not be the greatest at answering. So it's important to have high expectations, but also be okay with what sometimes is available and practical and realistic for the community. And it doesn't mean there's not national and other resources such as Sharsherit and others out there that you shouldn't seek that information from. So be your own advocate.
Thank you. And Rochelle, can you
I will answer last and then wrap things up. I think those are all absolutely wonderful takeaways. I think for me, the thing that I would suggest people need to know about breast cancer survivorship is to understand what's just happened. Right? I think we get off of treatment and we probably for the first time in a long time have an opportunity to really understand what just happened to us. And, during the course of treatment, we're really busy and active and making decisions and learning a lot, and the learning curve is steep. And we finally, during the survivorship period, have an opportunity to slow down a bit and take stock of what's just happened. I think the survivorship care plan that takes us back in time and helps us record what just happened to us is a critical beginning step in living a full life as a survivor. I'm always surprised at how many details I missed in the course of my own treatment and how important some of those details become later on. So I would say taking stock of what happened is probably a really important first step in becoming a survivor. So with that, I want to thank everyone for participating tonight. We had so much information from Dr. Klemp and Ms. Shockney. Almost hard to absorb it all. But the good news is we'll have a transcript posted online at www.sharsharit.org. And that will be available for you in case you want to look back and read a little bit more about some of the things you may have missed, or share it with a friend or your healthcare professionals. With that, also, we'll be sending you an email about completing a survey, and we'd really appreciate it if you took the time to do that. Your feedback is really helpful for us in building our programming. You know, I think tonight more than anything, we all recognize that survivorship is challenging and can bring with it just as many questions as the breast cancer diagnosis itself can. But there's support out there in navigating it and understanding it. And you can receive more information, resources, support, and your tailored survivorship kit by contacting Sharsharit. Find us on Facebook, on our website, call us toll-free. We'd love to connect with all of you. Thank you again to our speakers, and wishing you all continued blessings on this journey and every journey. Have a good night.